Council, this is the case of Zook versus Zook. So we've got a number of people on WebEx. Mr. Eisnagel, you represent the appellant and you are on WebEx, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. And we have several people representing appellees. Mr. Berrickman, which party do you represent?
Your Honor, I represent Jerry L. Zook, the appellee and cross appellant.
And you are on WebEx. And is Mr. Brown, you are here in the courtroom?
Yes.
Very good. And how are the appellees splitting your time this morning? 5 minutes and 5 minutes. Very good. Appreciate that. Do any counsel, either present in the courtroom or on WebEx, have any questions before we begin?
No questions.
Very good. With that, Mr. Eisnagel, you may proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is John Eisnagel, and I am the attorney from the, for lack of brevity, Bruner, Frank, Shoemaker, Hushock, and Simpson law firm in Kearney, Nebraska, and we represent the appellant, the now deceased John Marshall. Today, we are appealing the final order from the District Court of Dawson County on two grounds. First being that we contend that the trial court erred in applying the general tort statute of limitations under Nebraska Revised Statute 25-207, and instead should have applied the professional negligence statute of limitations under Nebraska Revised Statute 25-222. Second, we contend that even if the correct statute of was applied by the court in this situation, that the court should have found that the statute of limitations had run in this case and therefore barred the complaint against my client, Mr. Marshall. It is my intention today to address those arguments in that order. So starting with the argument basically on the professional negligence statute of limitations. In this case, the court found that that statute did not apply and the general tort statute did, based on the reasoning that the court could not say or would not extend the professional negligence to an insurance agent. We agree with the appellee in this matter from the Zook estate. When they filed their complaint, they filed it as professional negligence, admitting somewhat that that statute should apply. In Wareher v. Dynamic Life Therapy and Wellness PC at 302 Nebraska 1025 and 926 NW 29107, the court found that there are 11 elements to consider in making a determination of whether or not a profession, well, whether or not a career or job should be considered a profession for purposes of this statute. The first is a specialized field of knowledge.
In this case, about those particular items and the tests that set out, how is this court supposed to evaluate whether or not an insurance agent is a professional with the record that we've got?
That is a problem I considered while drafting my brief, Your Honor. And the one thing that the issue we had is we did a motion for summary judgment on this matter, and the court overruled that against our client and found rather that the general tort statute applied, making the issue at trial whether the general tort, you know, about the general tort statute. And so nothing was presented at trial to make that argument that it should be a professional negligence case. And that is an issue. I think the court should have reserved its ruling on whether or not that statute applied or not, and rather said, this is something that needs to be shown and is a general, is a issue of fact that is reserved for trial. And so that is kind of an error within the error of the district court that should have allowed us that opportunity, you know, to call other insurance agents or to have more specific questioning of Mr. Marshall at that time. But it not being in the record, there are general considerations that we just know. I mean, Nebraska has an independent insurance, Nebraska has a Department of Insurance that oversees a lot of this and takes issues and enforces our statutes and enforces standards within the profession. They have a body called the Nebraska Independent Insurance Agents of Nebraska, they give out awards to insurance agents every year. They have a specific field of work in applying people's circumstances to relevant policies. It's just clearly, in my opinion, a profession. And if you turn to Cooper v. Papp.
Does the profession require specialized knowledge?
I believe it does. They are required to.
How do we know that?
Well, we don't on the record, Your Honor. I have to admit that.
Isn't that kind of the end of it then?
Right. But I think that the relief that we should be sent then is to go back to the hearing and not have the district court prevent that evidence from coming in with their ruling on the summary judgment. That was the issue that we had, where the court says this doesn't apply. We're not hearing it. We're having a trial on the general tort statute. It didn't give us an opportunity.
You have the obligation in the context of the summary judgment to create a genuine issue of fact.
I think we did create a general an issue of fact. The problem was the court didn't find that.
I beg your pardon, sir. I think maybe that at the summary judgment was the opportunity to demonstrate by the proffer of evidence to the trial judge in making a determination as to whether or not it was a profession to offer some evidence that would meet the so-called 11 items. Wouldn't that have been the way to make the record?
I think that's something that could have been addressed with foresight, or maybe trying to file a second summary judgment would have been another route to go. Unfortunately, that didn't happen in this case. Turning your attention to Cooper v. Papp at 10 Nebraska Appellate 243 and 634 Northwest 2D, they found in that case that abstractors are professionals, and I would say a lot of the application that the Court of Appeals used would apply to insurance agents. If there's no further questions on the first error that we contend, I'll move on to the second error. And that is, even if we do find and apply the general statute, tort statute, the statute of limitations has run. I mean, the damage that occurred from Mr. Marshall's negligence in this matter occurred in the mid-90s. And this complaint's not filed until 2017 or whatever it is off the top of my head. The contention here is the court found that was told by the discovery rule, but the discovery rule requires that there be reasonable diligence involved on the part of the sufferer. And in this case, that's Mr. Zook and his estate, not, as the court found in its first ruling on this, the children and heirs to the estate. It was Mr. Zook. While he was alive, he needed to do the reasonable diligence to discover this error. He had the paperwork in his home in his safe. I believe that's in the Bill of Exceptions. He never called Mr. Marshall, and as Mr. Marshall testified, all it would take is for a client of his to give him a call and ask what's the status of his policy, and he can immediately look that up for him. Mr. Zook just let this sit and never cared about it. And now we care about it now because the heirs of the estate are out of some money, but he did not have the diligence here that would require, that would invoke the discovery rule in this matter. And because of that, this should have been lost.
Did Mr. Zook have any reason to believe that the insurance agent wouldn't file the change of beneficiary as he said he would?
I believe there are letters from the bank that Mr. Zook would have been aware that the changes were not made the first or second time. I'm not even sure if there was a second time, but the first time that he requested that, he was aware that it did not work the first time and there had to be extra steps. So that should have even put him on more heightened alert that he should be watching over this to make sure the change occurred, which he did not. And if there are no further questions, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Berrickman, are you going to be first?
Your Honor.
And Mr. Berrickman, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Claude Berrickman, Jr. I represent the appellee and cross appellant Jerry L. Zook. I will refer to him as Jerry to be clear in this argument. We believe this is a simple case involving a basic life insurance contract. Bob Zook died. Midlands Life Insurance Company contacted Jerry Zook, the beneficiary. A claim was filed and the proceeds were contractually paid to Jerry by Midlands. This was not a transfer of a benefit without...
Mr. Berrickman, just a factual question here. Did the insurance company contact your client first, or did your client contact the insurance company?
The insurance company contacted my client, Your Honor, and that's clear in the record.
Thank you very much.
This is not a transfer of a benefit without an adequate legal ground, which is required for a finding of unjust enrichment. Not a case where the insurance company made any mistakes or mistakenly deposited the proceeds in my client's account. The appellee agrees with that, or they would have sued Midlands Life Insurance Company and they did not join them in this case. Jerry Zook did nothing wrong, no fraud, misrepresentation, abuse of a relationship. Proceeds were paid pursuant to a valid contract for life insurance, and these facts prevent the trial court from finding that he was unjustly enriched. We cited the Marco case on page 19 of our brief. In that case, a father repeatedly and orally made it clear that he wanted his sons to have his real estate, but he didn't effect that in a will or a deed. And this court said, if we effect his oral intentions, no deed and no will will be secure. In this case, if you affirm the trial court's decision, no life insurance contract will be secure either. Court erred in finding that Bob and Jerry's buy-sell agreement addressed beneficiary closing or beneficiary designations. All it did was assign the life insurance policies by owner only. There was no reference whatsoever in the buy-sell agreement, which is an exhibit in the case, that gave any obligation on either party to do anything with respect to the beneficiaries. That was left up to the owners.
Mr. Berrickman, the trial court based its decision both on unjust enrichment and on a theory of a constructive trust. Is that correct?
That's true.
Would you address the second theory?
Sure, certainly. I will address the constructive trust requires a showing that Jerry obtained these proceeds by fraud, misrepresentation, or abuse of a relationship. And there's no such showing to justify imposition of a constructive trust. Essentially, by the court requiring Jerry to account for the life insurance proceeds, the court is essentially asking him to perform equity on himself. The appellees accused Jerry of bad faith in their argument with respect to the constructive trust. He simply exercised a legal and contractual right, and that clearly does not support the bad faith argument. That's my argument with respect to the constructive trust. The imposition was improper and should be reversed. Bob Zook and John Marshall had 24 years to make the absolutely necessary beneficiary change. Bob lost his wife a few years before he died. That'd be a good time to check on beneficiary change. And maybe he did. We don't know. There's one exhibit which came to light about a year and a half after the suit was filed that was an ineffective effort to change the beneficiary designation. Mr. Marshall testified that he would have informed Bob Zook that that form was ineffective. So Bob Zook always had knowledge, constructive knowledge, actual knowledge, that his beneficiary had never been changed. Hypothetically, what if Bob and Jerry were not related, if they were business partners only, but they remained close, played golf every weekend, or socialized? What if Bob and Jerry remained close after the split and did the same thing? What if Bob felt guilty about the way he'd treated his younger brother, his former partner? What if it was a $5,000 policy? Your Honors, I believe that these issues should not be addressed by the court. And they should not be involved in the reviewing of a life insurance policy, given that this was a valid contract and there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever of any wrongdoing by the beneficiary. The unjust enrichment finding was wrong, and it should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Brown, you may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is John Brown. I represent the appellees in this case, the personal representatives of the estate of Bob Zook. I can appreciate the policy implications in determining whether or not an insurance agent is a professional under 25222, but the record is devoid of any evidence necessary to make the 11 factor calculation articulated by this court a couple of years ago in the Ware case. I can also appreciate Mr. Eisenhagel's reference to what we know about insurance agents. And as I go through that list myself, it seems to me to be a lot closer to a massage therapist, as the court looked at in Ware, or to a real estate agent in the Tile case, where you have really no obligation to attend a specific school that requires specialized knowledge. You have to be a certain age, you have to pass an exam, and you have to complete certain continuing education.
Whose burden was it to make a record about whether or not we have a professional here?
There's no doubt that that was the burden of the appellant, Your Honor. They raised the issue at summary judgment. They didn't preserve that issue for appeal at the trial court by making an offer of proof, submitting any evidence of the, of any of the 11 factors, specialized knowledge, standards, members are committed to a certain type of work. None of that evidence was ever submitted to the judge. This case is really about the plaintiff's attempt to petition the court to correct an admitted mistake. Mr. Marshall admitted on the stand he made a mistake, that he was under the belief that the beneficiary in this case was Robert's wife and had been since the mid-90s when he intended to make that change on Robert's behalf. The petition to the court to make that change was twofold. First, to hold Mr. Marshall accountable for negligence, for his failure to fulfill the duty owed to Mr. Zook. And secondly, to disgorge those funds from his brother under a theory of unjust enrichment and constructive trust. The unjust enrichment, the theory of unjust enrichment does not require any evidence of wrongdoing. There are three elements to unjust enrichment: that the money was received, the money was kept, and in justice and fairness, it ought to be retained. Mr. Berrickman noted that there was no evidence of any wrongdoing.
How does the contractual relationship between insurer and beneficiary enter into the unjust enrichment discussion?
I don't think it does at all, Your Honor.
So any time that someone thinks that someone should not have been a beneficiary, unjust enrichment is an available theory?
If the facts support the allegation, yes. Mr. Berrickman also recited a lot of hypothetical facts about, what if they were two business partners that stayed close throughout the years? What if this was somebody who we wanted to have the money? Those weren't the facts of this case. You had the insurance agent testify on the record that he intended to change the beneficiary to Avis, Robert's wife, per Robert's request. And the test isn't whether or not Jerry Zook had a right to receive the money. The test under the restatement is whether he had a right to retain the money.
Both of your theories, unjust enrichment and constructive trust, are equitable theories?
Yes, Your Honor. Unjust enrichment does have a basis in quasi-contract, and there are certain situations in which an unjust enrichment can be a remedy at law rather than an equitable remedy. But in this case, we're applying to the court's equitable powers to, as I said, correct an admitted mistake.
So our standard of review is de novo?
Yes, Your Honor. The facts of this case is that Robert,
do you have to show that Jerry Zook engaged in some wrongdoing for both of your theories?
Not at all. No wrongdoing is required under a theory of unjust enrichment. As I stated, the three elements are that he received the money, retained it, and justice and fairness ought to be retained. There is no requirement that wrongdoing be proven in order for us to establish that injustice and fairness. The money ought to be returned. And
why would it be unjust or unfair for the brother of the decedent in this case to get the insurance money that is where he was named as the beneficiary?
He was left named as the beneficiary pursuant to a filing mistake, Your Honor, and I think that's what the record shows. Robert Zook had other siblings who he maintained close relationship with. None of those siblings were a beneficiary of any type of policy or insurance benefit. I see that I'm out of time. If I may just make one more point very briefly on the issue of wrongdoing and constructive trust.
You may.
This court in Pruss v. Pruss in 1994, which is a case Judge Doyle cited, said that the law of remedies for the proposition that the constructive trust is based on property, not wrongs. So again, it's removing that element that we prove that Jerry Zook committed some type of fraudulent or wrong act to establish we have a right to a constructive trust as a remedy. And with that,
Before you sit down, I wanted to ask you, what is your comment on when the statute of limitations began to run in this case?
Certainly, Your Honor. There is no evidence that Robert Zook had actual knowledge that Avis was not the beneficiary. So we have to look at what, you know, under reasonable diligence, should he have known? Reasonable diligence, pursuant to this court's dicta, is appropriate action where there is some reason to awaken inquiry and direct diligence in a channel in which it will be successful. When I asked John Marshall on the stand what he would have said had Robert called him and asked him who the beneficiary, he himself said he would have told him it was Avis. Everybody was on under the impression that the forms that had been signed by Robert Zook changing the beneficiary and submitted had been filed, and there was nothing on the record to indicate otherwise.
So you think that the time should have begun running when?
On the date of death, Your Honor.
Of
Robert Zook. Sir. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 1 minute, 48 seconds.
Mr. Eisenago, we will actually give you 2 minutes and 48 seconds, and you may proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Berrickman actually made a very good point of some specifics on the argument of when the statute of limitations should have began to run. And he noted the death of Mr. Zook's wife, which would normally for most people be an opportunity to go back and look into what their end of life situation would be as they're going through their wife's estate. I mean, we just have 20 plus years here where something could have been done, or Mr. Zook could have well been aware of what was going on. Addressing Mr. Brown's contention that it should have started on the date of his death, I think that's kind of a dangerous rule to have, where we're just extending complaints basically to the point of the next generation each time, where somebody can be on this earth for 50 years withholding or having the ability to make a complaint against somebody and not doing so and not discussing it, so we don't know what they knew and did not know, passing away and then passing on this right to make a complaint to their children. It has to be considered that when Mr. Zook had the reasonable diligence, or when he could have applied that. And the fact of the matter is, he knew immediately that there was issues with getting this changed over to his wife as the beneficiary rather than his brother, and he did no follow-up. He didn't call Mr. Marshall. He didn't talk to the bank that wrote Mr. Marshall the letter that's in evidence. He didn't talk to his brother. He made no other efforts. And I think Mr. Marshall testified that the last time they even talked about this policy was 1997. So we can assume what Mr. Marshall might have said if he did call him up based off what he was thinking on the stand the day of the trial, that he would have told him it was Avis. I knew Mr. Marshall my entire life, and I would guess that he would actually have, when a client calls, looked up the policy specifically. He might have said, it was Avis, let me grab it for you, and pulled it up. That's simply what would have happened.
So
Mr. Zook had the opportunity.
Go ahead. That the time for this began to run in 1997?
That is my contention, Your Honor. The second he knew there was an issue with this being changed over, that clock should have started ticking. And if there are no further questions, I will yield the rest of my time. Thank you for allowing us to appear via WebEx.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Eisnagel and Mr. Bergman, for appearing by WebEx. And Mr. Brown, thank you for being here today. That concludes arguments in Zook versus Zook. Counsel, you are excused. And the court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Evans versus Freedom Healthcare LLC.